Second hour, Darren, Donick, and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game on this beautiful Thursday here in Nashville. Darren McFarland, that's me. Willie Donick is over in East Nashville. Chase McCabe is actually going to be doing the afternoon show with Floyd Reese today. So it'll be Chase and the GM, and that's coming up at 2 o'clock today following our show. Don't forget Tim Kirchen from ESPN. We'll talk some Major League Baseball with him and their return to play and their plans. That's coming up in an hour from now. But we've our next guest is somebody we've talked to over the years. We always enjoy our chats with Don Van Atta Jr., who is on the line with us. He'll be a part of ESPN's broadcast Sunday night. They have been getting your attention on Sunday nights, as we have certainly talked about it in the months here on this show. And this Sunday, it'll be the backstory on the decision. Of course, LeBron James, it's hard to believe that it's almost been a decade since that, and that will be at 8 o'clock our time, which is Central Time, on ESPN this Sunday night. And Don now joins us. Don, how you doing?
Doing great, guys. How are you today?
We're doing fantastic. Thanks for joining us, as always. We're certainly intrigued by this, and gosh, how time flies. It is hard to believe it's been almost 10 years since, you know, LeBron James uttered those words that he was taking his talents to South Beach. So how did this all come about?
Well, we were intrigued to go back and find the backstory of the origin story, really how this particular episode was put together. That was one of the goals that we had with this particular episode. But we also wanted to see really what was the ramifications of that bad night of television. And we really wanted to see what the legacy of the show was for LeBron and his inner circle, for player empowerment, for storytelling by star athletes. But we had a lot of goals. We had really big ambitions that we were trying to meet with this particular episode. And I'm proud to say I think we met most of them. We found out a lot of new information on all those fronts.
So it's from things that I've seen or read on this that we're going to see on Sunday night, it sounds to me like then Commissioner David Stern was not a big fan of this broadcast, this decision being played out on ESPN. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. He did everything possible to try to get ESPN to cancel it. One of the things we found out that's new about that is he felt that ESPN was giving too much power to a single athlete. And he told John Skipper, who was then the head of content of ESPN, that the show should be canceled. What I found so fascinating is this is a business partner of ESPN asking ESPN to shut down a show because its most famous and its best athlete is taking too much control, and yet ESPN said no to a business partner.
Yeah.
And so I interviewed Skipper on camera, and he's very candid about it. He said, you know, Commissioner Stern did give us this advice, but we turned it down, and they went forward with the show anyway.
Wow. That is fascinating to me, because that is an interesting dynamic here on this, you know, station. You know, we're the flagship home of the Nashville Predators. We just signed a new deal to become the new home of Vanderbilt Athletics and the Nashville SC, our new MLS team. And so we understand that dynamic of working with a partner, and how sometimes, you know, the powers that be have to have uncomfortable conversations. And that is intriguing to me, how they handled that, because – and isn't it interesting, too, Don, how – what you just laid out. I mean, the NBA is about their star power, right? It's about their players. They have probably a bigger voice and platform than any other sport out there because they're very, very visible, and yet the commissioner was trying to stop this.
That's right. He was trying to stop it, and you're right. There's no doubt that of the major sports leagues in America, the NBA is best about really allowing their players to have a voice and to really step out and showcase them in really, you know, smart ways. And yet in that moment, in the summer of 2010, David Stern thought that ESPN was extending far too much power, far too much control to LeBron James, and wasn't able to stop it. And remember, the other dynamic of the show, I think a lot of people have forgotten, and we delve into this in the episode as well, is that that 1 hour of time for the decision was donated by ESPN. It was given away for free to LeBron James and his business partner, Maverick Carter. They were then able to sell that time to sponsors, and the money that they raised through that was then donated by the LeBron James Family Foundation to the Boys and Girls Club of America. So again, you have John Skipper telling David Stern in no uncertain terms, we're still going to do this, and yet the hour that we all watched, that absurdly bad hour of television in which LeBron was so awkward sitting in the chair, didn't even belong to ESPN. It belonged to LeBron James and Maverick Carter.
Wow. And so that important block of time, that hour of television, was basically a charitable donation, and yet isn't it amazing, Don, how much grief LeBron took for that? And ESPN, you know, everybody really kind of pounded that they were using that as kind of the pawn to have this whole hour-long show, as you mentioned.
Yes, everybody got beaten up over that hour and the way it was handled. And, you know, when we go into that in the episode and sort of explore the reasons why, it turns out one of the new things we found out is how little preparation LeBron James did before he sat in that chair. You know, you would think that Maverick Carter and the people around him would spend a lot of time scripting him, getting him prepared for what he was going to say before an audience of 10 million people. But LeBron was at his basketball camp in Akron, his Nike-sponsored basketball camp in Akron, in the week leading up to it. He flew into Greenwich, Connecticut late that day. He ended up going to a house in Greenwich, Connecticut, an agent's house, which was kind of a green room for that broadcast. He had dinner with Kanye West and shot a bunch of promos and then sat in the chair. And people around me said that LeBron never knew how many questions Jim Gray was going to ask. He thought it was going to be very just a, you know, little quick back and forth and then be asked where he was going. And then Jim Gray ends up asking 23 questions before he asks the money question about, you know, what's your decision? And just some of the inane questions he asked. Are you still a nail biter? You know, did you bring your powder tonight? And all of that, you know, made for a really bad night of television that everybody got blamed for, LeBron James and ESPN.
We're talking to three-time Pulitzer Prize winner Don Van Natta, Jr. He has put together this program called it's a program called Backstory, The Decision, on the LeBron James situation that took place almost 10 years ago. It premieres Sunday night at 8 o'clock Central Time on ESPN. And, Don, how was it decided that Jim Gray would be the interviewer?
That was the idea of Maverick Carter, LeBron's business partner, and Ari Emanuel, who is a high-powered Hollywood agent. Maverick Carter and Emanuel and Jim Gray were all at an NBA Finals game in L.A., Game 2 of the 2010 NBA Finals in Los Angeles. And at halftime, they spoke about this idea to do a one-hour broadcast. And so Jim Gray was part of the package then that Ari Emanuel brought to ESPN. Gray did not work for ESPN at the time. The folks at ESPN wanted one of their own to host the show, either the late, great Stuart Scott or Bob Lee, but it was non-negotiable. Again, all the shots for this were being called by LeBron and Maverick Carter, so Jim Gray was in that chair that night because that's who LeBron and Maverick Carter wanted to be in that chair.
What were the ratings like? As bad as the TV was, did a lot of people watch?
Oh, yeah, that's the thing. So 10 million people watched it. It's the most watched studio show, non-live event show in the history of the network. At the moment at 9:28 Eastern, when LeBron says, I'm taking my talents to South Beach, 13 million people were watching. So it was a remarkable, massive audience that ESPN had never had before. But as I was saying to you guys, all during that time, ESPN's not benefiting from all of those viewers because that time had been donated to LeBron James. They got the benefit of a lot of people watching the sort of the pre-decision show, the run-up up to 9 Eastern, and then the post-show at 10 o'clock. There was a three-hour pre-show and a two-hour post-show for the one-hour decision. So it was 6 hours of programming built around LeBron James's decision to go to the Miami Heat.
How this is what fascinated me. At the time, I was thinking, how could he do all this and not go back to Cleveland? But he somehow kept this under wraps, right? There was all these rumors, but I don't know that anybody broke the story before he actually said it. How did they pull that off?
That's a great question. So, well, one of the fascinating things for me as a journalist was to kind of figure out whether ESPN's own reporters were possibly asked or told not to do their job, right, which is break news and to get scoops. And I asked Skipper that question, and in the show, he answers it. He says, no, we told our reporters to continue to report it, and if they got the scoop and they were going to scoop LeBron, that was perfectly fine. Chris Broussard, who was an NBA insider and who I interview for this episode, he did report right before the decision started that his sources were telling him that it was likely going to be Miami, but he still had enough wiggle room where he said it could still be the Knicks or the Bulls, and he said that just moments before Stuart Scott threw it to Jim Gray and to LeBron James. It was just a very small circle of people that knew. The Cleveland Cavaliers didn't know what LeBron's decision was going to be until he was sitting in the chair. So LeBron's inner circle kept it very, very tight. And, you know, you think now, today, how quickly things break and how yes. hard it is to keep something like this a secret. That's another sort of remarkable thing that occurred 10 years ago, that LeBron and his camp was able to keep this under wraps so LeBron himself could break it.
Totally remarkable. And how long do you think he had had his mind made up? How many days in advance? Had he just done it the night before, or how long was he keeping this secret?
Well, that's something else that I tried to figure out for this show. And, of course, you know, there have been rumors all around the NBA that Dwayne Wade and LeBron James and Chris Bosh wanted to get together and play together. I mean, these rumors dated all the way back to 2006 when they played together on the World Championship team. 2008, they were teammates on the Olympics team. They loved playing together. They had the opportunity to sign five-year max deals, and instead all three of them signed three-year extensions, which guaranteed the fact that all three of those players were going to be free agents in the summer of 2010. So one of the things we tried to investigate is how early did LeBron and D-Wade and Bosh get together and figure out, okay, in the summer of 2010, we're going to get together and play with the Miami Heat. That's a really hard thing to prove, but we delve into it somewhat in the episode. But when LeBron was asked by Jim Gray, you know, in the chair that night, when did you decide? He claims he decided that morning after speaking with his mom. So, again, we'll leave it to the viewers to decide whether that is true or not, or whether, because you know, since the day before, guys, it was announced that Bosh was going to play for the Heat and join up with D Wade. So a lot of people who sort of knew about all these rumors that the big three were going to get together and play in Miami, as soon as they heard that news, they're like, oh, okay, well, the night of the decision, LeBron's going to clearly say he's going to the Heat to play with his friends D. Wade and Chris Bosh.
Well, I can't wait to watch this. Don, last thing for you from my end. I would assume in hearing you talk that it was somebody like LeBron's confidant, Maverick, as you said, that might have hatched this plan. But I'm reading the press release. I guess somebody had this idea outside of everybody's circle.
Yes, so that was one of the really fun, fascinating finds that we came up with. So, Jim Gray has insisted that it was his idea that he raised at the NBA Finals in June of 2010 to Maverick Carter and Ari Emanuel. It turns out the origin story goes all the way back to November 2009. A guy named Drew, I don't know his last name, just Drew from Columbus, Ohio, wrote an email to Bill Simmons in Bill Simmons' ESPN.com mailbag column and said LeBron should announce his free agency decision live on ABC. Bill Simmons then took that idea from his reader and brought it to Maverick Carter, Leon Rose, LeBron's agent, Worldwide West, LeBron's advisor, in February of 2010 during the Dallas All-Star Game weekend. And Simmons also pitched it. He was working at ESPN at the time, to ESPN executives. And for months, Simmons was trying to get Maverick and LeBron to do it. And then the idea really never went anywhere. And then suddenly this same idea comes up in June with Ari Emanuel, Jim Gray, and Maverick Carter at the NBA Finals. So we lay all that out in the episode. And it's just fascinating that, you know, you think about how bad that hour of television was, and then when you hear that a guy named Drew from Columbus, Ohio came up with the idea, maybe it makes a little sense, right, of why it was such a bad hour of television.
Oh, my gosh. All right, last thing, Don. Do we believe this was the start of kind of the, you know, joining forces in the NBA? Do we think, was this the decision and Bosh and Wade and LeBron the start for the next decade of what we would experience today in the NBA?
Yes.
Or do you believe it was somewhere else?
No, absolutely. And we spend a fair amount of time in the final segment of the episode that will debut Sunday night, delving into that. I asked Mike Wilbon about it. What's the legacy of the decision for player empowerment, the building of super teams? As you guys know, you don't even need to be a free agent anymore if you want to switch teams, as Anthony Davis has done and other players have done, Jimmy Butler. Just demand a trade and build these super teams. And Wilbon says, absolutely. LeBron's fellow players saw how it worked and followed his lead in what he did in 2010. So there's all sorts of fascinating through lines. We didn't even get into storytelling. LeBron now has media companies, Spring Hill Entertainment and Uninterrupted, where he's the executive producer of his own shows. We draw a through line from what happened that night in the decision and the control he got from ESPN to now how he's selling shows to multiple networks. And there's all sorts of fascinating legacies that came out of the show that we delve into in this next episode of Backstory.
Wow. Don, if we, for all the people out there listening to this interview, if they were kind of on the fence, whether they were going to watch Sunday night or not, I think you just convinced them that they're going to watch, because this was fascinating. Thanks for doing this, as always. It's always good to catch up with you. You and the family continue to be safe, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate it. And you guys be safe as well. We'll talk again soon.
All right. Thank you. That is Don Van Atta Jr. Sunday night, 8 o'clock Central Time, the Backstory, the decision. Gosh, hard to believe. 10 years ago, it's all coming up on 10 years ago when LeBron James told the world, 10 million people watching that, gosh, that he was taking his talents to South Beach. We will come back. More of Darren, Donick, and Chase on the other side. ESPN 102.5 The Game. Good stuff from Don Van Atta Jr. The decision, the backstory, this Sunday night, 8 o'clock on ESPN. RockNashville.com is your community resource page. Check it out for more information around town, including Nashville's Good to Go initiatives, CDC updates, ways to donate to Second Harvest Food Bank of Middle Tennessee, which supports their mission of feeding hungry people, as well as other ways to help the Middle Tennessee community. That's rocknashville.com. How do we think, and we're going to get into the, you know, we'll maybe bring up this element with Elliot on the hockey side, which, by the way, it's getting pretty interesting about the hub cities. It seems like Vegas is going to be a lot.
Rumblings.
But maybe shifting up in Canada. It doesn't look like I'm starting to see a lot more about Vancouver may not get this after all. And it may end up being Toronto, where Elliot resides. May end up being Toronto. At least that's
it
what
looks
I'm
like
seeing
there's
out
a push.
There.
It looks like there's a push. And if there's anybody that's going to know, it's going to be Elliot. So at 1 o'clock, I think this could be a great time to have our weekly chat with him, because – something tells me he is going to be in the know.
No doubt. And so that's coming up at 1 o'clock today. But let's talk about, you know, when these things, and I said yesterday, I'm getting a little bit, even though we've had, gosh, we just continue to have incredible interviews, and that's what's made this fun. You know, tolerable is a little bit of a strong word. But, you know, it's tough. 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, talking about nothing that's really happening, although a little bit's coming back. I'm more than ready for things to come back. So we're inching a little closer to that, and let's hope that it all happens and it takes place. So with that being said, how are we going to judge all these champions? How are we going to judge the 2020 champs? How do you think we're going to – how do you answer that? What would be your answer? Like, we're going to be – the NBA is going to crown their champ. The NHL is going to crown their champ. Major League Baseball will crown their champ. I mean, everybody's going to still crown their – NASCAR is going to – although NASCAR, you could say – I mean, they're going to – with them, like, this weekend, you know, two cup races, Saturday and Sunday in Pocono. I mean, they just continue to pump out races. So their season may look more normal than most. So I don't even know if they fall into this category, but how do you think we'll view the other sports with their champs? What will we say 5 years from now?
It's a good question. Before I answer that, Darren, can I ask you one question before we turn the page on the LeBron James thing? Which,
yeah,
that totally got me fired up. I had seen it. I guess I might have watched it, but now for sure, I'm like, got to set the DVR. This is
I'm watching it.
I don't want to miss
for sure.
This because this is going to be fun.
Yep.
Did you watch it live? Did you watch
yes,
the coverage?
I did.
You did.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Because I think that was a time, Darren, that you and I had been separated. We were not working at the same station. I was on the air that day. We were doing a radiothon that particular day. So I'll always remember that. And, you know, you were part of many of those radiothons. We were soldiering through, still on the air while that was going on. So I didn't watch any of it. I was just getting it all secondhand. We didn't even have a TV on while it was going on. So it was weird for me. But I just cannot believe that he went to the trouble of doing that at that place only to not go to the Caps. I was so stunned. I was like, how could you do that to your hometown?
Well, it is amazing. Look, you weren't the only one that felt, because I, you know my relationship with Matt Lodi and people that I know up in Cleveland, and you can imagine how consumed they were with that offseason, right? You know, leading up to that, I think it was early July of 2010, leading up to the decision when he aired this that we're going to see on Sunday night. You can imagine that market, that's all they talked about. And they truly, depending on the day, the hour, they didn't know. Like that, I think that was why it was a great question when you asked Don about, how do they keep this under wraps? Like, I just feel like today,
it's amazing.
There's
it's amazing.
No way today you could do that. There's just no way.
I mean, Twitter existed back then, but not in the form
it did.
That
it was
does
at
now.
The
it
very,
had not taken off.
Yeah, it was early, early stages. In fact, that's when I had just signed up for Twitter. Around this time, because I was starting a new venture with Terry McCormick, and had to get on social media because we're working with 24/7 Sports and they're all about social media, right? And all about the internet. So I had just, or maybe I hadn't even signed up just yet. It was probably in July of 2010 when I had signed up on Twitter. So I had just started, but it was out there. It certainly didn't have the platform that it does today. It is amazing how they were able to keep that under wraps, but I would talk to people constantly and they truly didn't know. It just, like I said, it depended on the day, the hour, the wind patterns on where they thought LeBron was going to, if he was coming back, if he was leaving. It's amazing. Where today, I feel like that would be an impossible task.
That was a phenomenon, looking back on it, for sure. So now to your question, how will we view the champions? This is an important thing that I think has allowed me to settle and just take it as it comes. Like, as we were talking about yesterday, in another 10, 15, 20 years, if we're lucky enough to still be around and talking about these things, we'll always remember 2020 for a lot of reasons and the uniqueness of it. And hopefully it's only 2020 and not too much of 2021, right? Before
hopefully.
We get back to
yep.
the routine, let's hope and pray and all that stuff. But it is going to be a level playing field, regardless of the sport, right? Everybody is going to have to go through the same trials to win a championship, right? You can say in some circles, right, let's take the NHL, that if somehow miraculously a team like the Florida Panthers catches lightning in a bottle and goes and wins the whole thing, you would say, ah, man, it's a great run. But did they really deserve? Were they even going to make the playoffs? I don't know. But what you can say is they will have earned it, right? They will have gone through all of the challenges that everybody else had to go through in getting your team back, getting in shape, you know, playing at your best in these circumstances. So that is significant, right? So it'll always be in our minds that was 2020. But I don't think it takes away from the achievement if a team wins a championship in that. You know, it won't be the same. It'll be very, very different. But the level of achievement, I mean, that's going to be special, I think.
You think?
Because you'll be dodging and weaving all of these things.
Yeah.
The discipline. Like, If you're, what we found is if you are undisciplined with this virus, you're way more likely to make the mistake of catching the virus and unfortunately spreading it to others who may be trying to be careful. But it's going to take discipline for these teams to stay in the bubble, stay mentally sharp, you know, hang in there, you know, go through the trials and obviously play really well, right? These are challenges that not every athlete has had to, that no athletes have had to go through before. And as a team, you're relying on all your teammates to be disciplined and not get out of line, especially if you're like baseball and you're not even in the bubble where there's nothing that's going to keep you from going down to the bar and you know, finding other people that don't care about the virus and having a good time, right? And you could be jeopardizing your team as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, if you go through all this as a player – and a coach, I guess you're going to feel it's going to be weird because you're not doing it in front of fans. It's that there's going to be a level of weirdness for sure. But, yeah, I mean, I guess the satisfaction will definitely be there. I'm just curious because you're right. I mean, I do wonder, too, does it matter, you know, let's say for the NBA purposes, if it's not the Lakers, if it's not the Bucks, like who's next got the high – Marquise, who's got the next greatest odds?
Clippers. Yes.
So let's just say, for whatever reason, it's not the top three teams, which is rare in the NBA. They get the fewest upsets. Let's say it's not the Bucks, Clippers, Lakers, and somebody else wins it all, which I think is probably a little bit of a stretch, but let's just say it happens. Does that change, Willie, what you just laid out, does that change everybody's mind about how they felt about it? Because
everybody's
got to
make up
out
their own
go,
mind.
Well, yeah, look why they won it. I mean, this team had three positive tests, you know, in the conference final. They lost their one superstar, had to go away for two. You know what I mean? They'll instantly go to reasons why it happened. True?
Right. Yes, but there are a lot of championships where you can come up with a lot of things to say, well, this is the twist about this championship. Let's take the 87 NFL season where they had the replacement players. You may have watched the 30 for 30. The team that won the Super Bowl that year was the Redskins, right? And their replacement team had a hand in that, right? Because those games counted. It wasn't any of the players that played in the Super Bowl. But had they not gone 3-0, and in fact, one of the big parts of the story is they beat a team of Cowboy players that had a lot of people crossing the picket line and playing. So they were playing against real NFL players, at least to an extent, and they got a big win. You know, but nobody goes back and says that championship was different, really, unless you want to go down that road. The history is there, right? But that's just one example. Or the 1981 baseball season that had the strike in the middle of it and they split the season, and the team that had the best record in the National League in all of Major League Baseball, the Reds, weren't even in the playoffs because of the rules, right? But the Dodgers won the World Series, and you know they're the champions, just like Washington was the champions in that Super Bowl season. So if you want to taint it, or if you want to look at it, it's going to be different. There's no way around the different part. But the level of achievement, I still think, is worthy.
Okay, so let me ask the best example I can come up with. Let's go over to our NBA desk.
Hello.
Okay, yeah, Marquise is standing by. So here's the best example, or the latest example I can think of. So you follow the NBA closer than us. What do people give – when people talk about the Toronto Raptors winning it all, what do they say? Is it just, wow, what a great story, what a great run? Like, what is there? We all know how they won, okay? We know why it happened. And I think we all can safely say, if all those injuries didn't happen to Golden State, they're not winning, okay? They were a great team, but they weren't going to win. Do people hold that against Toronto?
No, actually not, because of the hatred for the Warriors. So they were just looking for somebody to beat.
Right, I understand. Like, people are like mad because they just gathered all these superstars, and it was kind of a joke. You know, it's like the final piece is like, oh, like you're just throwing in DeMarcus Cousins, really? Like, are you serious? But so people, so I get it, the envy of the Warriors and what they were able to do. So people don't say Toronto was the champ, but
no,
we know why. No,
no. I mean, look, that was a good team, and there's some people that actually think that Toronto has a good chance of coming out of the East in this playoffs, even without Kawhi Leonard. So, and that's kind of where, like, I was going to ask you guys this. Is it different for the sport? Because we obviously, with the NBA and NHL, we played a season, so there's not that uncertainty. But with baseball, it is. It's like they haven't played a game yet at all. So even though the Dodgers and the Yankees are the favorite, if it's somebody else in baseball that wins a championship, do we still look at that differently, even though they haven't played a game this year? Because with basketball, we already have, we kind of already know who the teams are,
right,
that are going to be the favorites going into the same thing with hockey. We knew going into the Stanley Cup playoffs who were going to be the teams that were going to contend for the Stanley Cup. So, but with baseball, they haven't played a game yet. So even if a team like the Marlins won a championship, we don't know how that Marlin team would have looked like if the season would have started, right?
Or yeah, if you would have played the whole 162.
Yes.
Like, that's the thing about a baseball season. The cream rises to the top. Usually your weaknesses will get exposed. The best teams end up getting there. Of course, injuries play a part of it. But on the other hand, I think it's pretty legit because everybody is starting from the same point. Everybody is playing 60 games, and the surroundings, the atmosphere is the same for everybody. So, it's different that way. Like, what is more legit, I guess, if you want to use that word, playing a season from start to finish under these circumstances, starting from scratch, playing to the end, even though it's only 60 games, or taking a 3-month pause, like basketball and hockey are doing.
Yeah, and Darren, to kind of answer your question, in the NBA, they really don't look at any of these championships like as tainted championships, because when you look at the Spurs and that lockout year when they won the championship, Miami's first championship came off of, you know, after that lockout suspended like the first couple months of the season. And no one bats an eye at that at all in the NBA. It's just kind of like, yeah, they just won a championship. So, you know, the Spurs, they were just the better team that year. They won the championship. Same thing for the Miami Heat. Like, we knew going into it, they were going to win the championship anyway at some point, and they did that year. So that's kind of how they look at it in the NBA.
Okay, good to know. I was curious. I know it's not going to be an exact apples to apples comparison. You can compare really nothing to 2020. I don't think we'll have any true
how do you comparison. Think they'll look at it in from an NHL perspective?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking it. I would say that I don't know.
Because the NHL already has, like, that unpredictability anyway, though, right?
Yeah, that's no doubt.
So even if a team, like, I don't understand if it's, like, one of the teams like the Blackhawks or somebody like that who wins a championship and they shouldn't have. I'd understand that point. But once we get to the cream of the crop, the 16 or 20 or whatever, once we get to that certain number, won't it just be like, okay, now that realness, that unpredictability that the Stanley Cup playoffs usually have is now back in effect?
Yeah, the good news for the NBA and the NHL is they played, especially the NHL, they played more games than anybody, right? They were more closer to the finish line of their regular season than the NBA. And so they get that kiss. And they've kept it intact. Yes, there's an additional early round, best of five, but once they get into their traditional 16 teams first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs, it's best of seven. So nothing's really changed on that front. It's exactly the way it always is once you narrow it down to the 16 teams, minus, you know, obviously the atmospheres and traveling and going and playing on the road and having fans in the stands. But other than that, it's the same format. So I would say, Willie, that helps the NHL because they were close to completing their regular season, closer than anybody else, and their playoffs are basically going to look the same, minus this little qualify to get it down to 16.
Right. I think that's the difference with the baseball is you might have, even though everybody's starting from the same spot, you might have somebody make the playoffs, maybe even win and get to the World Series, right, where you say, that is a really weird team. They were not expected. It might be a great story, right, if the White Sox, you know, just have 60 great games, you know, which can happen in a part of a season. You know, some pitchers can be great for 2 months and not so great the other 4 months. But if it's your two best months, maybe you put together a 35 or 40 win, 60 game stretch, and you're in the playoffs. That is where history will say, you know, would they have made it over 162 games? But these are the rules. Everybody's playing by the same rules. Everybody's under the same circumstances. So I think it's legit. It might be fun.
Yeah. All right, we'll come back. Max Herz, Anchor Down Podcast. You can check his work out there. He does a really good job of covering Vanderbilt athletics. We'll get into some stuff with him on the other side to close out the second hour of Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. We caught up with Max Herz, Anchor Down Podcast, right before the MLB draft. Only 5 rounds this year. A little bit different, of course. We were talking about a Vanderbilt player, a baseball player that we thought would go maybe top 3, ended up going 5th overall. But there's a lot of things we're going to get into on the Vanderbilt side with Max. Max, how you doing?
Doing good, guys. Good to be on with you again.
I was listening the other night, coming home from baseball practice, to your podcast, and I think you were talking with Harrison Ray, I believe. Good conversation with him.
It was good. I got him and Tanner Duvall right after the undrafted signing period. So like you said, that MLB draft was really short. It got cut from over 1,200 players to 160, which was ridiculous. From anyone else who wanted this sign could only get $20,000, which was also ridiculous. But they could pick wherever they wanted. So it was pretty interesting to hear from both of them why they picked the places they picked. Ray went to the Blue Jays. Duvall went to the Mariners. Basically places that they felt like believed in them, had a plan for them, and places they could play and develop.
Yeah, and we're going to get into more on that front. We're also excited that we made the announcement this week that the football team and the men's basketball team for Vanderbilt Athletics is now under our umbrella at Cromwell Media. So we're very excited about that, and that will get cranked up this upcoming college football season on 93.3, our classic hit station. But, you know, I got to start on a little bit of a tough note. News, not so good news earlier in the week coming out where an ex-Vanderbilt staffer accused former Vanderbilt linebacker Charles Wright of rape. And there was, I guess he was found responsible for a Title IX violation in which back in 2018 he was expelled on that. But there's some former players involved in this, and gosh, it seems like, you know, there's too many of these cases coming out involving former Vanderbilt football players, or, you know, at the time some of these have come out, they were current Vanderbilt football players. But yet again, another not so easy subject matter, talking about some bad things happening over on the campus of Vanderbilt. What did you make of that?
Yeah, it kind of came out of nowhere this weekend with, I think, either 3 or 4 former or current Vanderbilt students coming out and speaking about their experiences and making accusations of sexual assault towards Vanderbilt football players, mostly on Twitter, was where it was done over the course of about a 24 to 36-hour period this weekend. And one of the statement from the athletic department and from athletic director Candace Lee this week was, We trust the Vanderbilt Title IX office to go through the process, but in one of the accusations, the one that you mentioned, was with a former member, a student member of the Vanderbilt football staff, basically, who was working on the equipment staff at the time, and a player on the team at the time, Charles Wright, who you mentioned, that one went through the Title IX office, and according to the documentation, he was found basically guilty of what he was accused of. And there's some murky timeline with when that happened, whether he was still allowed to participate in team activities, even though he wasn't playing in games. And allegedly, this was before he was involved in Vanderbilt's pro day. So I imagine there will be some sort of internal review of that. But they went through the Title IX office. They did what the athletic department is saying is the process, which, I mean, is the correct process, whether it's within or without athletics in terms of something like that happens on the Vanderbilt campus. But there are definitely some things that probably should be looked at there by the administration, but I think it's in the very early stages. But it's admirable for the group of people who came out with their experiences to come out the way they did. And I think certainly it will be a topic of discussion moving forward.
Yeah, and one of them was a former Vanderbilt track athlete who accused former running back of Vanderbilt, now the fullback for the Titans, Kari Blasingame, of raping her in 2016. So, gosh, just hard to believe. You said, and candidly, the AD and the chancellor did put out a pretty long statement. I think it was it yesterday or the day before, I guess, touching on these subjects.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens, but I hope some action will be taken, that's for sure.
How we haven't heard anything from Derek Mason, the coach. When do you think we will hear from the head coach? I realize this is the time of year typically in June. You're not hearing from the football coach, but I do wonder when he's going to address this, or will he address this?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if anyone on the beat individually has tried to reach him for comment and gotten a no comment. There hasn't been anything like that I've heard of. But between the shutdown, this being the dead period for coaches having contact with their current players, even though the players can be on campus and working out, it's not with coaches. It's the no hours of coaching time of the off season by the NCAA. So you're right that this isn't the time of year that we would be hearing from him. I'm not sure exactly when that would happen, but I imagine there will be some questions that need to be answered at some point. So either once team activities begin, again, everything goes according to plan, but who knows when even under a standard off season in 2020, when media will be allowed in the same room as players and coaches again.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of moving parts, that's for sure.
No doubt. It seems like the NFL is going to go the direction of kind of leaving it up to the states, the individual states, the markets, and what state they're in on how they're going to handle attendance this year. It'll be interesting to see how college football handles attendance as well. And so how do you think it's going to look this year in the SEC? And if it's left up to each individual school, how do you think Vanderbilt, obviously I'm asking you just to throw out your opinion, but how do you think Vanderbilt would handle that if that were the case?
I do not know the current number of Vandy football season ticket holders, but I imagine unless we are somehow still in the same phase we're in now and we don't get to the point where sports can open back up, I know this has been the big topic of conversation with everything going on with the Sounds this week, and they're obviously hoping to play sooner. But as long as we get to that phase, I think there would be, I mean, within the local law, there would be a way to get at least all the season ticket holders in. And from there, if you can let more in, you do. But I think their minimum net should be okay as long as there are no setbacks. But it will be interesting to see what happens, that's for sure.
Talking to Max Hurst. And so, Max, just your love of the baseball and knowing what's going on here, just give us your thoughts on what we're going to see here, what we hope we're going to see on the Major League Baseball level in terms of the new rules and, you know, just the idea of a 60-game season. You watch a lot of SEC baseball like we do, and we talked about this yesterday. It kind of gives you an appreciation for an SEC series of three games and how magnified each game is, the difference between 17 and 13 in the league and 13 and 17 could be, you know, just a couple of bounces of the ball one way or the other. I saw it written today, a 7-game losing streak in a 60-game season is like a 19-game losing streak in a 162-game season.
Yeah, this is the same way I've been thinking about it. I'm glad you phrased it that way in terms of preparing for the college year. It's a 56-game regular season. Last year, Vandy won the conference tournament, went all the way through, won the national championship, and they played 71 games. And that's basically the most you can possibly play. So I think it's a totally fine number. I am obviously the opposite of a purist, as you could tell just by saying that. But I think the season needs to be shortened significantly in a regular year. It should be 120 at most. Obviously, that's not going to happen because of the money that's in place. But the owners have shown their opinion that they want as few regular season games as possible, at least if there are going to be no fans in the stands, and that the playoffs is where the real money is made. So if the playoffs are going to get bigger, maybe the regular season can get smaller. I think it could go down as low as 100 and still be fine competitive balance-wise. And all the people who have said things like, oh, if we played a 60-game season last year, the Nationals wouldn't have made it in, or this team that ended up being terrible would have made it in and would have been the second wild card. Well, last year, they didn't know it was going to be a short season. I mean, it's not like we're going into the season and we're saying, okay, we're going to stop at a random point. We're not going to tell you guys. And that might happen if the season gets shut down, but we're not going from there. They know it's going to be a 60-game season. They know when the last game is. They know what they have to do to compete and to win. And I think hopefully, maybe not, but hopefully it encourages more of the lower teams that wouldn't be able to compete for a 162-game playoff spot to try and get in with the shorter year, especially because the schedules are different and teams aren't going to have to play some of the top teams that they compete with usually.
So, Max, you've been following this closely. We were just talking to Adam Neuse of the Sounds earlier about, you know, what's happening with players that are unsigned right now, some former Major League players that don't have a contract, and how Nashville could become their home. What about the fact that there's no minor league baseball played right now? What happens to all the Vanderbilt players signed professional contract? Where do they go? Where are they working out? What's the plan?
You mean the guys who signed this year?
Well, I'm talking about Austin Martin and the guys that just got drafted. What is the protocol for new draftees?
Yeah, so they don't know, and they're not necessarily going anywhere, which is the interesting part. But in terms of just Martin, to be the fifth overall pick, he could end up on the Blue Jays taxi squad, which we now know is 30 players. There were so many iterations of this that went around, but it's going to be a 30-man roster for your team and then 30 extras who are within your organization who are working and training somewhere else. He could be on that extra 30. That doesn't mean he's going to play in the majors this year. It would take a pretty catastrophic situation to get him into the majors this year, I think. But I think they would want him in that group. So in his case, he could be there. But everybody else who would normally be going to single A or short season ball, you're just kind of left on your own and told that there's going to be, if everything is safe, some sort of instructional league or a deeper fall league than usual in September or October, and you're just kind of waiting for that. But, yeah, the players don't really know. The agents don't really know. I think priority number one is making a major league season happen, and anything else that can go on beyond that is great. But the Sounds thing is interesting to me because if you're signing, is it two groups of 40 players I saw? So if it's that deep of a group, there are going to be a lot of players who are signed with affiliates right now who deserve to be on that team, and free agents are getting the chance to play instead. So it's interesting that you can go that deep into the free agent pool, whereas every single individual team isn't going that deep into their own organization.
Max, do you know who you've got coming up on your next podcast?
I do not. I think we're going to do a look back at for the one-year anniversary of the national championship, which is tomorrow.
No, gosh. It's just hard to believe. I know. Yeah. That would be good. That would be good, though. If you go down that path, that would be a fun listen. Thanks for doing this. As always, we'll chat soon.
Yeah, thanks, guys. See you soon.
All right, that is Max Herz, Anchor Down Podcast. Check it out. He does a really good job covering Vanderbilt athletics, and certainly you hear that interview. His passion is with the baseball program, which he was around a lot, and it's hard to believe. Gosh, 1 year ago, what, tomorrow it will be when the Vanderbilt Commodores were crowned national champs. We will come back, start the third hour, speaking of baseball. Tim Kirchen from ESPN will talk about their return to play, what that format is going to look like. We'll talk all things baseball with Tim to start the third hour. Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game.